Welcome one and all, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and I am joined by my two compatriots. There is Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Hi.
What's up? And also Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
Hello. Today we will be giving you our usual feature review prefaced by a movie discussion in honor of Harmony Korine making a jump to the semi-mainstream with Spring Breakers, which will be our feature review. We will be talking about small slash independent slash esoteric directors who've made the jump to the mainstream. After we get done with that discussion and our feature review, we'll be telling you the best bets for things coming to DVD and into theaters in the coming week, and then giving you a random recommendation of something that we've seen on our own. But if you're a regular listener, you probably knew all that. But here's something you didn't know. We're going to be implementing a new system this podcast, which will allow you, the fine folks at home, to use the chapter selection arrows at the bottom of your podcast player to jump to a specific section. So if you would really like to hear us talk about the directors that we think have gone mainstream and have had varying levels of success, but you want to hear what we thought about Spring Breakers first, you can use the chapter selection arrow, jump forward, listen to that, and then come back and listen to the rest of what we have to say. Yeah. Or if you know you don't want to get spoilers, but you want to know if we think you should see the movie, you can skip over the spoilers and still be able to hear us talk about things coming to movies next week.
But seriously, listen to it all.
Oh no, listen to it all. But this is allowing you a level of freedom in the arrangement in which you listen to us. It's just something I felt like I should do for you as kind of a spring break present. So yeah, that's going to be happening. That being
very
said,
thoughtful.
Right. I'm a swell guy. Don't let my prickly exterior lead you astray. I'm actually quite kind. That being said, you should definitely subscribe to us on iTunes. Drop us a comment and a rating because, you know, we appreciate that all the time. And since I'm being so nice to you, you'll have something wonderful to comment about. Also, as anyone who listened to last week knows, we had a prize. We had a giveaway. And someone, some lucky person, won a DVD of Rust and Bone, which is a fantastic film, and I'm insanely jealous. And for anyone who's interested, the winner is Levi from Texas. So congratulations, Levi. We appreciate you entering. Sorry to everyone else who entered but did not get the prize. But keep listening, because, you know, we'll probably do it again. Not for Rust and Bone, obviously, but for something else equally as wonderful. That's it. That's all. We had a lot to talk about at the top, but now is the time for us to get into our actual film discussion. Now is the time for us to get into the actual show proper. So let's talk about some independent movie makers who made the jump towards the mainstream. And Danny, let's start off with you.
All right. Well, I have a pair of examples here, and they're probably not the best examples you come up with, because they're both kind of household names by now. The first one's Christopher Nolan and the second one's Steven Soderbergh. But I think they both kind of, they're two very different careers in terms of how they sort of adapted to the mainstream. And I think that's kind of interesting. With Nolan, his kind of first and his only sort of super kind of esoteric non-mainstream movie was Following, which was only made for like $6,000. And, you know, since then he's become more popular year after year. And now he's one of the biggest names in the industry. But, one of the interesting things about his filmography is that a lot of the ideas that he's known for right now in terms of these kind of psychological themes and these puzzle piece narratives are very much present in his, debut film. So he's kind of a director, he's an example of a director who's been able to sort of retain his original flavor throughout the more mainstream films that he's made. And I think that's kind of, that's admirable. And Soderbergh's a little different because a lot of his earlier films, with the exception of Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which won the Palme d'Or and is kind of widely considered to be one of his best films, but a lot of his films after Sex, Lies, and Videotape are kind of lesser reviewed and not quite as renowned as some of his other works. But once he kind of hit the mainstream with Out of Sight, and then, of course, in 2000 with Aaron Brockovich and Traffic back-to-back, he sort of developed a new identity, and to the point where now he kind of – people kind of recognize him kind of fluctuating between different projects and taking on new themes and subjects with a lot of his films. So, you know, whereas Nolan is someone who's kind of kept his same signature throughout, regardless of the scale he's working on, Soderbergh is kind of the opposite in that sense. So those are kind of two different possible routes that a director could take.
Excellent. And Nick, thoughts and any additions you'd like to make?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with what Danny said insofar as you could agree or disagree, which I don't think is very deep, admittedly. But yes, we're all being very amiable on this episode today. You know what's funny about Soderbergh is I don't know if anybody here has seen Kafka, his second feature. Anybody?
I do not believe so.
No.
You talked about this on a previous episode, didn't you?
Yeah, that's correct. The funny thing about Kafka is that it's actually a sort of a long, slightly rambling, extremely personal artistic statement that comments upon the very real fear that an independent filmmaker can have about going to Hollywood. The entire movie is actually a large metaphor for that, where Soderbergh is Kafka, and he's being put into this position by these higher powers because of stuff that he's been doing that's been catching people's attention. And if you see that movie and you keep it in mind, it is something that I think informs a lot of his career, actually. So it is funny how someone like Steven Soderbergh maybe was a little ahead of the curve there in terms of predicting that indie cultivation that we keep seeing. And Danny, you say how there are those two directions that they could take. There's another one that I think is probably the what is the exact term for that? The warning signal, warning story. What is help me out here. Cautionary tale, exactly. And that would be David Gordon Green, who started out making films like George Washington and Undertow and All the Real Girls. And then in 2008, he had Pineapple Express, produced by Judd Apatow. Big hit. A lot of people like it. But after that, he went in a direction that a lot of people would – well, not a lot of people. Everybody would consider the nadir of his relatively short career, actually. But it is still a pretty clear point where things went wrong. And he had The Sitter and Your Highness, two movies that nobody liked.
I didn't even know that he did The Sitter.
Yeah, he did.
He did The Sitter.
I'm kind of hilariously unaware that that actually came out. I remember a whole lot of advertisements for it, and then I don't ever remember it actually being in theaters.
Right. You weren't sure if it was a real movie or just a... Anyhow, so there was him, and then he's actually, interestingly enough, started to kind of go on an upswing because he has this movie, Prince Avalanche, that's played at a few festivals. Jordan saw it at Sundance and really quite liked it, and people at South by Southwest were fans. So I think he showed that two things. One is that you can, in fact, crumble before the public's eye, but you can also make a reascendancy, which is kind of what Soderbergh did in some way, except it wasn't as public, which is probably for the better. But that's who instantly comes to mind, and because it is a cautionary tale.
Hopefully he's back on track, though, with Prince Avalanche. I think that's what it's called.
Yeah.
And Joe, starring Nicolas Cage, which sounds kind of interesting.
Nick Cage, he's nothing if not a wild card. So
yeah, that's true.
Time will tell. Obviously, we'll be talking about Harmony Korine. I wanted to bring up Rian Johnson, who went from the low-key heights of Brick, which was acclaimed and won a special jury prize at Sundance, and then The Brothers Bloom, which I don't remember being out in a lot of theaters. And then he had a big hit this summer with Looper. And I feel like now he kind of is probably going to get a little more of a carte blanche for his next project. So I'm very happy about that. I'm happy with all the interest that he has gotten from the mainstream because of the success of that film. A selection of someone who's going to be experiencing the phenomena we're talking about is Colin Trevorrow, who directed Safety Not Guaranteed. And he has recently been tapped to direct the fourth Jurassic Park film. Yeah, so he's going to be doing that, which is weird. Did we all see Safety Not Guaranteed?
No, but I did see the trailer, and just from that I can say, does not equate to Jurassic Park.
No, I mean, I'm all about interesting choices as far as, like, directors for projects. There is, however, something so strange about this that I'm just not sure how I feel about it.
Yeah.
I heard someone explain it pretty well, is that they probably... The thing about Jurassic Park 4 is that it's coming out in only, 15 months or so.
Yeah.
And they said that probably what's happening there is that they have about 45% of the movie done in post, the animation process and whatnot. Mm-hmm. They just kind of need someone to go to a set and tell actors to stare in awe at things, in which case he'll do just fine.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I saw Safety Guaranteed. I quite enjoyed it. I liked the little character moments, and I think that it balanced out the more fantastical elements of its script very well with all the more grounded human stuff. So it'd be great if we could have another Jurassic Park where there are characters that we like, I guess. I just don't understand it, but it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But yeah, I mean, in general, do we think this is a good thing? Because I know in the music world there's that idea of selling out. I mean,
are you talking about Colin Trevorrow specifically?
Or? I'm talking about in general, we have... It seems like we have the two ends of the spectrum where Christopher Nolan has managed to keep his style pretty much intact and he's adapted it very well to a larger mainstream audience. And then you have David Gordon Green, who did The Sitter and Your Highness. And so I'm wondering, like... Is the trade-off of getting a Nolan or a Soderbergh out of it every so often worth the usual sacrificial Gordon Green?
You know what's funny about Gordon Green is that he's roundly defended his decisions post, I guess it would be, Snow Angels, which was the last movie that fit his original style. Mm-hmm. He has said that this is not him selling out. This is just... what he's interested in, and in fact this is him being allowed to do what he likes.
Right.
It's not that he is doing this for money. I doubt he's even getting much money for directing a movie like The Sitter. It's because he thinks it's funny and wants to do it. Right. But I do suspect that he understands that his reputation has crumbled pretty much entirely, which also is why he goes back to do something like,
Prince Avalanche. I mean, the thing is, no one ever admits to selling out. I mean, like, that's...
Yeah, that's
and it's
true.
Really hard to prove what... I mean, because success brings money. Like, if you're doing well, I mean, eventually someone's going to accuse you of selling out. It's just sometimes I know it hurts a little bit, the idea of, like, this great independent voice being shackled to some massive intellectual property. And, yeah, it kind of bums me out sometimes. I'm glad that Christopher Nolan, however, was able to overcome that. And, I mean... Rian Johnson is going to, he says, continue only directing things that he himself has written. So, hopefully there's a little bit more of that and a little bit less of some of the other shit that's happened. Danny, you were going to say something?
Just as kind of a segue from the discussion of the review, it's just kind of funny to be talking about this topic in the context of Harmony Korine, because it's not like... It's not like Following is kind of on the same level of obscurity as Trash Humpers. and it's not like Spring Breakers. I mean, Spring Breakers only really cost like $2 million. It's not like it's kind of a huge mainstream thing, even though it's getting a lot of buzz. It's more like his whole persona is kind of built on doing things that are unexpected. So it's like no matter what he does, even if it's like a jump into something more mainstream, it could almost be interpreted as being, even more experimental or whatnot, if you want to make that argument. So it's just like, I mean, if we've had trouble defining the topic in previous directors, it gets even crazier if you're like bringing it in the context of this guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh my God. Yeah, I think that is an excellent segue, so perhaps we should now get into our primary review. Gentlemen?
Sure.
All right. That brings us to the end of our movie discussion. If you have any directors that you can think of who fit these criteria that you'd like us to bring up perhaps on the next one, the next podcast, let us know at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Otherwise, we can move into our feature review of Spring Breakers, which hit wide release this past weekend. Directed and written by Harmony Korine, starring Vanessa Hudgens, Selena Gomez, Ashley Benson, and Rachel Korine, as well as James Franco.
All I know is I'm not going to sit here another day.
Spring break.
How are we going to get enough money?
I don't know.
We're the only ones still here.
Spring break.
I'm tired of seeing the same thing.
Spring break.
It's your chance to see something different.
Spring break.
Just get that cash.
Pretend like it's a video game.
We can do this.
Spring break.
Y'all, you can change who you are, y'all. Bikinis and big booties, y'all. That's what life is about.
Spring Breakers is the story of four college girls who go to extreme lengths to get to spring break in St. Petersburg, Florida, and continue to go to extreme lengths while on spring break. It's best to leave most of the plot discussion for spoilers, because I feel like this is the first movie in a long time that genuinely surprised the hell out of me every couple of minutes. Just in terms of both like directorial decisions and plot, this is not a movie I could get in front of. I was never around the curve from it, waiting for it to catch up with me. So, I mean, that's one of the chief joys of it as far as I'm concerned. So that's, a preview of my review. But let's start off with Nick and see what you thought of Spring Breakers.
Oh boy, how about this movie, eh?
Wow.
How about it?
Can we just leave it there?
Absolutely not.
Okay, fine. Play it that way. Yeah, so Spring Breakers is a film that I would say probably works best as a 45-minute featurette, as opposed to an entire feature, because I think that there are moments of transcendence throughout, and I think that Korine is clearly in command of his visual palette, which is this repetition that kind of puts you in the mindset of the main characters and makes their conflicts and experiences supposedly all the more involving. But while that's all good, there is a certain point where I think the movie starts to state its thesis, and you realize that it's been building up to this, and once you get to that thesis, you also realize that the movie isn't actually that interesting. And by the end of it, I was actually a little, I don't want to say exactly disappointed, because it was still sort of what I was expecting, but at the end of it, I found that it was not saying anything particularly profound or insightful or even, honestly, even that interesting. Ultimately, Spring Breakers is an interesting misfire that I think will probably warrant some multiple viewings, because there are things in it that I like, and I feel like those will only become more and more highlighted throughout. But at the same time, I can't entirely reconcile what Korine is trying to do here thematically and on a grander narrative level than what it simply starts out with, which is far better than what you end up getting.
All right. And Danny, what are your thoughts?
Well, I quite liked Spring Breakers, even though I think that four of the five main characters aren't that interesting. And I think that I think that probably there are some sections in the first 45 minutes where it's very heavy on these four girls and kind of trying to establish the monotony of their college life. I think there are parts of that section of the film that are a little repetitive and not particularly as sort of effective as the visual palette would have you kind of want it to be. There's sort of like these really well put together scenes that are also kind of boring. It's a little weird. But I think the movie picks up an incredible amount of momentum when James Franco really sort of becomes the center of the film. And I think one of the reasons why that part surprised me so much is because I was kind of expecting this movie to be a sort of degradation of spring break culture and kind of shooting it down. And it kind of turned out to be something a little bit different. And my favorite parts of the film, really, which were Franco's interaction with these girls, they kind of had nothing to do with spring break. And I think that's kind of what surprised me about it. But at the same time, I think that that is also a reflection of maybe some confusion on Corinne's part about what he was going for and what kind of effect he wanted. But it also contributed a kind of surprise and a sort of different experience than I was expecting at the outset.
So I think I'm going to be the person who is the most positive on this film. Because
I mean, I'm pretty positive.
Yeah, but I know. I'm just saying I'm probably going to be the most positive. I didn't say I was going to be the only one who was positive.
Fair enough.
I had no idea what to expect going into this film. And what I got was definitely different from, I guess, what I would have been forced to expect in retrospect. And yeah, I had a blast with this movie, guys. I was sitting there in a state of kind of elated shock for most of it, just because I was like, I can't believe that I'm sitting watching this kind of movie in a theater packed full of college students. And oddly enough, like a family with two young children, which was a huge mistake on their part. But I looked back during the trailers and saw these two kids sitting on their parents' laps. And I like wanted to do like, get out. What are you doing? I did not, though. So those kids, their lives are changed irreparably. For better or worse, we cannot say. But yeah, aside from a little bit of inelegance regarding, I think, you know, some of the themes and thesis of the movie as spelled out through some one-sided phone conversations that we get every now and then, I feel like this movie is pretty much incredible. And I really don't even know, man. Wrapping my mind around the sheer bulk of insanity that I was exposed to, and just the propulsive nature of the way it's constructed, and the colors and the performances, which were like surprisingly good from these women who, just through my exposure to them in pop culture, I was not expecting a lot out of. I don't know. It, like, the entire thing kind of blindsided me. When I walked into the movie, I could not have expected that I was going to be getting a profanity and violence laden like dubstep mix up of a Terrence Malick film, and yet that's what it was, and it was amazing. So yeah, I guess that's as spoiler free as I can get.
It's funny you say propulsive, because I find that the repetitive nature of it sort of mires it structurally and narratively, where it's not really moving anywhere for much of the runtime, which I understand is the point, but
right.
As I said in my illustrious Letterboxd review.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's right.
I constantly forget that I have a Letterboxd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said that sort of this not really going anywhere begins to feel like I was a spectator, and I was reminded of what someone once said about watching a movie about a drug addict, or a movie about a person who's doing drugs and they're having a great time. If you're not doing the drugs, it becomes a little boring because you're just kind of sitting there observing, but you're not partaking. And I do think he does. I think Corinne is admirable in his attempt to make us feel like we're part of that action. But to me, it felt like it was all at a distance for much of it.
But see, I feel like it was supposed to be at a distance enough that you could kind of see the absurdity of it.
No, I think there is an absurdity to it, but I think we're invited into the absurdity.
I guess.
And one thing that has been coming up a lot in discussing this movie is people debating whether or not it's ironic, which I don't think it is.
Oh, you
I
don't?
Think that it's, no, I don't think it's – no, I do
I
not.
I think it takes the concept of the spring break culture to an ironic extreme.
No, I have to disagree there. I don't think it's ironic or a parody. I think it's straight-faced.
You think it's a full-up... Do you think it's a celebration of it, or it's like a, attempting to be documentarian? And if it's not ironic, what on earth is it?
I think it's Harmony Korine's typical dive into this seedy underworld. And I don't want to say it's a celebration necessarily, but I don't think it's a condemnation.
I feel like given... okay, so let's talk about how the movie opens. I don't know. Like, I don't want to ruin the surprise for anyone, but, you know, this isn't... you're still going to have to go through it when you see it.
That's how it opens.
The movie, yeah, the movie... But I mean, like, it's such an in-your-face opening. It opens with that one song by Skrillex where the kid screams, "Oh my God."
The one song that goes... Yes, that one Skrillex song, yes.
That's like, this is the only one I think that I've ever heard by them. To just know it because the kid screams, "Oh my God." I don't know if that happens in all their songs. I'm woefully out of touch with the youth culture. That's what being 25 does to you, apparently. So this is happening, and it's just a like slow motion montage of topless women, a shit ton of drinking. Even though in this movie, and you know, I'll have to go through scene by scene to really, you know this for sure, I feel like a greater volume of alcohol is poured onto people than is actually imbibed. And,
that might be accurate. Yeah,
yeah, that's probably accurate.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, and you know, I've been to parties that approach this. I've never gone on a traditional spring break, but I've been to Bacchanals that approach the shit that I've seen in this movie, and it's true, people do that. I don't fucking know why, but I'm a hardcore alcoholic, so like the thought of wasting alcohol to me is just repellent. But when you see that opening with the Skrillex music and the slow motion and the close-ups on the butt clapping and the topless women, I don't feel like that's someone approaching that in like a documentarian, like, look at this, this is what it is. I feel like they're definitely making a statement about the bombast that is supposed to be inflected with some kind of, you're on the outside, can't we see how crazy this is, even though it might be fun to be part of it? Because everyone seems to be having a blast.
Yeah, this was kind of where the film took me by surprise, because definitely in those opening frames, I was like, okay, this movie is going to be Harmony Korine kind of like giving a middle finger to the people who would probably be going to this movie in terms of like these very people, like teenage, early 20s partiers or whatever. But maybe some of it's Franco, but I feel like as the film goes on, it's just kind of this strangely authentic, like, three-way. And I feel like it has nothing to do with Spring Break and its best moments. In terms of, like, James Franco just being this kind of awesome gangster, like, showing his stuff off and trying to like hit on these girls. I don't really know what the comment there is on spring break culture. And that's kind of both a reason why I liked the film in a way I didn't expect to, as well as maybe a sign that like Korine didn't even know what he wanted to go after in a sense.
Well, I think a lot of Franco's personality is embodied in the repeated phrase spring break forever.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like he is the logical or illogical, if you will, extreme of the spring break culture. He is nothing but flash and showiness and the awesomeness of being amazing and drunk or high all the time. And he offers these women a way into that world. You know, the I don't give a shit, let's just party all the time. Look at my shit, I'm awesome. So, I mean, like, I don't know if I need to see this movie again, one, because I enjoyed it, but two, because I feel like there are some different themes playing around in it that maybe I didn't fully pick up on, or I don't know how they all connect. But I feel like if his character serves a purpose beyond just being amazing and redeeming him in my eyes following Oz, it would be that.
Yeah. You know, the thing about Alien, or Aileen, A-Lean. The thing about him is that he's a much more interesting character, much, much more interesting character than any of the four girls. And I once he's introduced, I just could not be bothered with any of them, honestly. because I didn't care much to begin with, even though I think there are interesting things being done with them. I think it's an interesting reflection of that current generation. But how am I supposed to care about these Disney actresses who, once they're occupying the same space as Aileen? And I don't know, maybe that's part of the idea, but it didn't work for me because after that point, I just wanted to see more and more of him. I was not getting tired of all that.
I just like
because there
say,
was so much of that.
I like how you say that generation as though you're not a part of it.
Well, yeah.
Like you could say that subculture because I feel but, like you're not part of that subculture, but you are firmly within that generation.
All right, subculture, fine.
There
fine.
We go. All right. the purpose of his character, again, was to be that outsized thing. And I think you're never going to be able to be a normal person next to him and come out looking like the most interesting person in the room.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not going to happen. The problem there is he doesn't have a lot going on upstairs, I feel. So I was less psychologically interested in him than I was in the women.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I feel like it balanced out there. But, I mean, like, as far as just pure entertainment value, he's bananas, and it was awesome to watch him do his stuff.
Mm.
Yes. Holy crap. And I actually, we can get into more specific moments in spoilers, but I feel like the character played by Selena Gomez named Faith, for me, was actually a huge part of my enjoyment of the first half of this movie.
I am a little uncomfortable with the depiction of that character.
Is there a particular reason that's not spoilery, or should we jump into
it? No. I'm not sure if I particularly, quote-unquote, like the way Corinne is treating her. It seems a little mean and easy and unfair. So, yeah, and I feel like I haven't seen much discussion of that, but it felt like an issue as the movie was progressing.
Okay.
And
we'll put a pin in that for spoilers because we don't want to give any character specific moments away. But yeah, I think I know where you're going to come from, and I think I can possibly get behind it. Did any of the other female characters, the quartet of women that we followed, did any of them strike you as particularly interesting on a thematic level?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I would say that probably the. It's what I said. It's that depiction of the subculture, which I felt was very accurate. And what I said again in my how many times am I going to say this? My letterboxed review. It's so sad. It's like, you know, yeah, my community theater play. In it, you know, I said how there's sort of that post-millennial aggression, which I think Corinne is very good at depicting in a scene where they reenact their robbery of the restaurant, I suppose it was.
Yeah.
Which, it's funny how he sort of mirrors that and then expands upon it later on, because when you see it originally, there's something sort of elegant about it where it's these hooded girls who are going into a restaurant and you silently hear them, you silently see them pointing guns and smashing a sledgehammer on a table.
Yeah.
And it seems almost sort of innocent because of the way the girls have been depicted.
And it's also like that scene got a huge laugh from my audience.
Yeah, because it is a funny shot.
Yeah,
but
no, well, not because of the reasons you're saying too. Like we've seen these girls as kind of like the flighty, you know, party girls, and they're just like, hey, we need money, let's go rob a restaurant. And then you've got the one in the car who's just circling the restaurant and seeing them through the window, and it just seems like so far out of character for them that it's a little bit hilarious to imagine what they're doing in there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when you actually get that turn and there's that great parking lot scene where they're reenacting it and you start to see what's happening inside, that was fantastic. I loved that.
Yeah, and that's not necessarily an individual character thing so much as it is a unit, which I liked. I like that they were, as three girls, they're more a single unit, because I can't remember the names of any of those characters. The only one I can remember is Faith, because it's this hilariously, intentionally on-the-nose naming. Otherwise, yeah. They're all sort of this amorphous piece, almost a corrupt the corrupted generation as one.
Yes. I can get behind that. Though I do think that I think that the characters of Candy and Britt, played by Vanessa Hudgens and Ashley Benson, are kind of the amorphous corrupted generation. And I think that Rachel Corrine's Cotty, Cotty, is that how they pronounced it? I don't know
if they ever said her name.
I don't know if they ever said her name either. I just knew her as the one with the pink hair. But I think she
Harmony Korine's wife.
That's his wife?
I think, yeah.
That's bananas.
Yeah, he's 40.
How old?
Back to your comment.
Oh my god. She is 1 year older than I am and he is 40. Anyway, all right. I'm going to need a moment to really process what I've just learned. Anyway, so Rachel Corrine's Cotty, I mean, she's the... I hate to use a word that is reductive as slut, but I mean, like, she... There are numerous scenes of her being, like, naked and sexually aggressive, and, like, I think the most alcohol poured on a single person in this movie is on her. And... Mm. I mean, like, there's just scenes of her doing that. And so she's the kind of, like, the teasing slut college student cliche. And the way that her character is challenged throughout the film and the way that it eventually comes to fruition, I feel like sets her apart. So I feel like, you know, I can understand a little bit what you're saying, but I think it's not as amorphous and all-encompassing as you made it seem, Nick.
Mm.
But we're kind of dancing around a lot of stuff. So anyone opposed to jumping in the spoilers?
Let's do it.
All right.
Let's
we're all saying see this movie, right?
I would say see it. Yes, because it is, you know, it is unique. So
yeah. And wait, so am I a little bit insane when I said that it was like the candy-coated dubstep mix-up of a Terrence Malick film?
For the first half it is, and then it
loses
no
a little bit of that later, but yeah. Okay, I just needed to be sure, because when I was sitting there and I first made the connection in my head, I thought that maybe I was having a stroke. But let's move into spoilers, guys, so we can talk about the plot of this movie a little bit and see where that takes us. Let's start off with the faith discussion. Nick, what were your thoughts on this character, and how did you respond to the way that she was treated?
To me, it felt like Corrine was pointing his finger at and laughing at the young religious set, which I just didn't. I don't know. I wasn't jibing with that, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it's as a person of faith, it's usually pretty easy for me to feel uncomfortable about things like that in a film. I'll usually put it aside though, because, you know, movies are movies, whatever. I actually feel like I was totally on his side, though, which is bananas. But, you know, I went to a school that had a pretty heavy party culture, and I went to church every week. And I started going to church off campus because the church on campus was too much a little bit like that. You know, it was like the gathering in like a rec room and holding hands and singing and talking about, you know, how we felt God's love in our life today. And it was, and just like the attempt to really pander to a youth culture through like the young hip preacher in a shirt in like the spiked hair talking about how awesome the Lord is, like, that never appealed to me. Like, that is just the worst as far as I'm concerned.
Really? It seems like it's right up your alley.
Oh yeah, no. I love earnestness and touching people and being in a community. Ugh, fuck. No, so I was there with it. And like, as much as I could appreciate the idea of her, you know, finding something in there and believing, it's how it feels. I don't think there is a single good way to shoot a scene like that. You're never going to make that seem less weird and alienating than it is. And I say this as a person of faith who was parts of things like that and ended up probably missing out on a lot of really important and formative friendships because I couldn't take people seriously after I'd seen them in a situation like that. So, I mean, I didn't like that, but I understood where it was coming from. And I like the fact that it wasn't just her doing that for the sake of it and, you know, easily corrupted or, you know, kind of sneering at these people behind her back. Like, her earnestness not only in the words that she spoke, but the way that she acted in certain situations was actually really effective for me. Especially in the parking lot scene where she starts off like giggling and part of the fun of this reenactment until she really starts to see like the viciousness and cruelty that her friends are celebrating. And, you know, we start off like her on these people's side because we saw it from the outside. But then the more into it we get drawn, the more we start to realize that maybe there is something wrong with these people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then coupling that with her eventual breakdown, and just like she is the only one of them who gets out of this movie basically unscathed. And so I feel like if he were really being that cruel to her, he would try to break her down. She's the only person who has something as that's a piece of her that she values, and he lets her keep that intact. And not only that, but she removes herself from the situation which would have destroyed her in some way.
Yeah. Okay, but isn't it easier to... I don't know. It feels too easy to try and do that, but also to build up to it the way he does with these scenes that, I don't know, it made me feel very uncomfortable. I didn't...
Which scenes in particular?
Well, you know, the scenes when they're at the campus church. I am not a person of faith, and I generally object to that kind of treatment of religious text and teachings, but something about laughing at it, again, it not only feels too easy, but it's mean.
But I don't feel like he was particularly laughing at it. I feel like it's just one of those things. You can't do it in a way that doesn't elicit some kind of reaction from people who aren't part of that.
But I don't know why he would. I don't know why he would decide to show it that way if he wasn't.
But I mean,
playing it up for some sort of effect.
What other way would there be to show it?
Just her going to church.
Because I guess like that's possible. But like the fact that she is part of that group, and the fact that that is something she's obviously sought out, I think speaks a lot towards her character. Like she's a woman who is in search of family and faith now that she's missing from her actual family and she's at college. And so she's found this group of people, and you can tell that she's not as 100% comfortable with it as everyone else is, but she's still enjoying it insofar as it's nourishing her on like a spiritual and social level. And I think that showing her, you know, sitting alone in the pews of a church wouldn't hold the same effect, because it wouldn't let you into her head. It wouldn't let you see her desire to be a part of something.
All right. That's fair.
Yeah. Because I'm like a loner. I'm not a people person. I don't know if people could, you know, guess that from listening to me over the past 11 months, but it's just not who I am. So I never could have been a part of something like that. So I know her in a general sense. I know her type of person, and it helped me to really get in touch with her and understand her as a character. And it made her breakdown at the pool hall all the more affecting, because she didn't want to leave her friends. She wanted to leave the danger, but she still cared enough about her friends that she was just hoping that they would come with her, and that the women that she had spoken to outside of her church would be proven wrong by the innate goodness of her friends, which never came to pass. It was hard. It was a legitimately affecting scene, and I think Selena Gomez was actually fantastic in it, which is like weird, because about 3 years ago, as a joke, I started saying that my favorite singer and actress was Selena Gomez, because I had no idea who she was, but I'd seen her on a magazine, and I was ironically trying to be like fake cool by just talking about some kid that was popular on a show that I'd never seen. And so now I'm just like, well, now what do I do? Like, that joke will never work again, because I've actually seen her in something and she was really good. And yeah, it was a heart-rending scene, because as the square in a group of friends, the person who's like, hey guys, maybe we shouldn't break into this person's car to steal the gun we can see peeking out from under a sweatshirt, you're not doing it just because it's your morality. You're doing it because you don't want your friends to plunge further into whatever madness has already taken hold of them. And so you're not doing it for yourself. You're doing it for all of you, because you feel like as a group of friends, you should be looking out for each other instead of just looking for the next high. So yeah, that's what I think about
that
character.
That's definitely fair.
All right. That is my defense of Selena Gomez's aptly named Faith. So that's cool. And that gets us into, I guess, you could call it a narrative device in this film. there's kind of a, you know, 10 Little Indians thing going on where one by one the girls leave. So first we see Faith go right after they meet Alien. And then it takes Cottie getting shot in the arm to literally not, you know, giving her a shot in the arm, but actually literally having a bullet plucked from her arm for her to leave. And she's the one who, like I said, was kind of doing the played up college slut thing. And that's the thing, like, you, for all of her acting in that way, do we ever actually see her engaging in any actual intercourse?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because to the best of my knowledge, we do not. And that says a lot about her as well. Because she wants to be the center of attention, and she wants to have fun. But the second that something threatens to become real, you know, she has to get out of there. And so I think that her being the one who actually ends up with the most scars, probably both emotionally and physically, and suddenly realizing, like, this isn't a joke, this isn't play acting, like, this is real and things are going to happen. Having her leave after that was actually another thematically resonant thing. I mean, does anyone want to add on to her her arc?
Well, not so much her arc, but I was rather amused by the way in which he uses the bus as a transition point in the movie. How
yeah.
they seemingly just go from this one position to they're on the bus, they're traveling, and then they're there. And then it is sort of like this heavenly, no pun intended for what we were discussing, this heavenly item that delivers them from this evil place.
Yeah.
I thought that was very clever, the use of the bus. It was one of the more interesting things that happens after the introduction of James Franco, which maybe that says something about the movie as a whole, the way I was starting to feel, but that was appreciated.
Excellent. And yeah, let's talk some more about James Franco. What the hell is going on there? his character of Alien is by far probably the part of this movie that people who are not interested in talking about the psychology of church-going college students are going to be talking about. Specifically, he has a speech that goes on seemingly for days about all of his awesome stuff with the repetition line, "Look at my shit."
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be one of those people that, like, people are going to see this movie and he's going to become like the new Joker, the new Heath Ledger's Joker, where it's like everyone's going to like have their shitty impression of Alien from Spring Breakers. And the arc of his character, how are we feeling about the way that he pans out in this film? Danny, do you want to jump in on this one?
I mean, I guess I was a little upset that he just kind of dies because he was so fun. But I mean, I think you made a comment earlier, Brian, about him not being like a smart kind of guy. And I mean, something about the way it must have been the way Franco played him, but I actually thought he was like a really kind of complex man. And I think there were like a few scenes, like you mentioned the scene where Selena Gomez leaves. And like right before she leaves, she has a scene with James Franco that's kind of like really creepy.
Yeah, that was disturbing.
It's like disturbing, but it's also like vaguely he understands her in a sense that like he's like, "Your friends are here. Like, I think you'll have a good time." But then she says she wants to go and he's like, "All right, like go." Like, he takes a little bit too long to get to that point of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like he like says some things to her that maybe like even the other girls like wouldn't say to her. Or like, I mean, I think it was telling to me that like right when she's about to get on the bus, the other girls are kind of just like hugging her and laughing. Like, once she leaves, we'll be able to go back to partying.
Yeah.
But like Alien's the one that kind of takes her aside and like has like a life lesson conversation with her. So I think that was maybe a key scene for me in terms of like thinking of him as like a actually maybe an intelligent guy.
Yeah, no,
like,
he's definitely crafty in that scene because it'd be very easy to make threats. And I think a stupider character would have done that. But yeah, you're right. He does. He clocks her as a person who wants to be included and starts saying like, you know, "You can leave, but your friends are going to stay." you know, isn't that going to be awesome? And then he gives this creepy little, like, I'm going to be thinking about you while I'm with them.
Oh, yeah, that was a little bit, okay.
Yeah, and then just the with is a very low with.
That got a big laugh from yours truly. It was my kind of line.
That's a bold line.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very he's a very intelligently aggressive character at times when dealing with people one on one. But I mean, during the montage set to Britney Spears Every Time, I think we see his like gleeful, anarchic, like small child with a gun phase.
Which, by the way, I have to say, I don't think that sequence is meant to be taken as something that literally happens.
I can't imagine that it actually was.
Yeah, I don't think it's... Because I think it actually sort of... I think it goes against a lot of what the movie is doing, and I think it goes against the character of Alien, who, in fact, I think is actually... You might think I'm joking when I say this. I think he's actually very sympathetic. And I think he's built as someone who's sympathetic.
No,
because
I think he is. Yeah. I don't deny that.
Because he's, you know, clearly not very smart, but he's not malicious either. There's that line about, yes, the friends thing, but I think it's also about how you read that line. It's not meant to be taken one specific way. And Franco's portrayal, too, he's someone who, you know, you like him because he is funny for certain reasons, and he doesn't really seem like he, even though he owns a lot of guns, he doesn't seem like he really wants to hurt anybody.
No, definitely not. And I think that the way that he goes down absolutely bolsters that opinion.
Mm-hmm.
He postures himself so much, and then he doesn't even get halfway down the dock to go kill his best friend, who's like starting a turf war, and he gets shot by some lackey who never even gets a face, let alone a name.
Mm-hmm. The enemy is played by Gucci Mane, who I guess is a rapper. I don't really know. I've heard the name, but I don't really know anything about him. And I thought going in that he was actually Gucci Mane, the character, which he sort of is in a way, because he's barely given a name. And I suppose if you know who he is, you're kind of in on a joke that it seems like Karina's is playing up here, which was amusing because he's actually... very funny in the movie.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is an American rapper. He debuted in 2005 with Trap House, followed by Hard to Kill, Trapathon, and Back to the Trap House.
Mm.
This is all coming off of IMDb, so thank you, IMDb. Like, we're talking about that montage. Yeah, okay, so... I just have to say this out loud to, like, force it into reality. He's sitting at a piano by a pool by the ocean, and the girls come out in pink ski masks, all of them cradling automatic weapons, I think except one has a shotgun, and they ask him to play something inspiring and uplifting, and he starts to play Britney Spears Every Time and sings it to them, and then it melds into this gleeful melee of violence and theft, which... I cannot believe is actually happening. Or if it is, it's not happening to the extreme that appears to be depicted. Because, like, okay, so they tie up some people in a hotel room and steal some shit from them. That's fine, whatever. I guess that could happen, and no one would care because they're a bunch of drunk spring breakers. But I mean, like, there's a point where they legitimately crash a wedding party and, like, slam the groom's face into the cake. Like, that cannot have happened, correct?
Yeah. I mean, but also because you see Alien commit an act of violence where he's pistol whipping somebody, which doesn't feel like an action he would take based on everything that you've seen of him beforehand. Or at least it doesn't seem like an action he'd take in somebody who's tied up.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And and there's blood in that scene. Like, it's the only part where we see blood up until Cotty gets shot. But it does make me wonder, though, because there's a point where he has to pick these girls up from a bridge, and they have money. Like, they have obviously just done something. So I feel like if anything, it's that the montage is like their ideal of what their life is going to be like now with this guy who's going to let them be as like awesome and freewheeling as they want to be.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think part of why, like, the second half of the film works so much for me is because it's like the girls, especially those two, are kind of like the blood hungry kind of killers. And he's this more kind of, you know, he doesn't like violence as much. So now that I think about it, that montage is probably like him playing this song to them and them fantasizing about like killing people, which is a little bit bleak.
But, absolutely.
But I mean, it's pretty authentic to where the film goes from there. That seems like a pretty accurate.
So this can be our final thing. Do we feel as though these people have become reformed? The two remaining girls, Vanessa Hudgens' Candy and Ashley Benson's Britt, because they slaughter an entire party full of people. They shoot Archie, played by Gucci Mane, in the face. And then they steal his car and drive off into the sunset. And this is preceded and slightly concurrent with a scene where they're calling their parents and explaining how, you know, this trip has like shown them who they really are and they've met great people and that they're going to try to like live better lives. Are they really going to live better lives, or have they just finally found a life that they think is better? This life of crime and violence. Where do these girls go from here, guys?
Where do they go from here? As I can't say I really care, honestly.
Back to the fast food place. They left a few.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they just go back to their regular lives, which is so probably what is... because, you know, it's the American dream. You can change who you are.
Yeah. But, I mean, they changed who they were into mass murdering criminals.
Yeah,
so you think the ultimate change is them coming back?
I think they go back, but they go back different people.
Murderers.
Murderers.
You
yeah,
don't
I
think
mean more than
continue to murder, though.
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
I just part of the problem is, you know, this is a very sort of literal question, but who would they murder? Yeah. Just, you know, because no, the movie doesn't really present much evidence that they have. I don't think they have a huge incentive to kill necessarily. I think that there's a lot of posturing in their actions up until the end.
Yeah.
So even though, yes, there is that explosion of the pent up rage, I don't know if that is going to lead into further acts of violence per se.
Okay.
Yeah. Just a quick point, actually. Something that I felt in relation to like their tendencies as violent people is just the idea of that opening robbery. And I mean, just the idea that they would do that to go on spring break, it almost posits them as sort of violent figures before they even start killing people. And I think it's an aspect of the film that sort of confused me a little bit, because watching them rob the store felt like an event just to kind of get them to Florida, but it's actually sort of like a really kind of twisted, disturbing event. And so I don't know if the ending is like just them kind of escalating even further, or if it's them like now that they've done that, they can go back and like go back to their other lives. I don't really know.
They got their dream shot and it's over now.
Yeah, or something. I mean, like, because I don't feel like if the movie is kind of trying to be a critique of spring break culture, I don't feel like the average spring break person would commit a robbery like that.
I would assume not.
And so I don't quite know what that means yet.
I feel like, just, you know, to close out my thoughts on this film, I feel like that is it's almost as much a critique as of the importance that is put on spring break culture as it is on the culture itself.
Oh, that's a good point.
And this, you know, because these people feel like they have to, like they must get there because like their lives are pointless and meaningless, and the only thing that's going to give them anything is to go to this place where they can cut loose and be who they really are. And Selena Gomez proves that she always is who she really is. She's the only one of them who's allowed to be the way that she is. Cotty understands now that, you know, there's a fine line between dancing close to the fire and jumping through it. And the other two are psychopaths who have no problem killing and stealing to get what they want. But I think that they realize that lifestyle is vaguely untenable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of heavy discussion going on in a film that has James Franco as a rapper slash drug dealer named Alien, starring numerous former Disney girls.
Yes.
But yeah, I obviously, you know, we've been talking now about this film for, we're at the hour mark. So yeah, I say definitely see it. And it's currently probably at the top of the films that I've seen that have been released this year.
Yeah, having said all that, I do wish I did like it a little more. And I think I prefer the main poster to Spring Breakers as a whole. I feel like I get most of what I need from that.
From the poster?
The poster where, yeah, it's the four girls who are leaning over seductively and James Franco behind them.
Yeah, the one on the
posing IMDb with a gun.
Yeah.
One of the girls is holding a gun. I feel like that is basically everything I needed from the movie.
I gotcha.
Distilled into one.
All right.
Check out Trash Humpers next.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. So that brings us to the end of the discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, hopefully you enjoyed it. Now let's talk about very quickly what is coming to DVD in theaters, and then we'll give you very quickly again our recommendation of something we watched on our own, and then we can get out of your hair. So, March 26th, Blu-ray and DVD. We have new releases. Lincoln.
Starring
Daniel Day-Lewis. Steven Spielberg, director. I know that some people on this podcast like that movie quite a bit.
Yeah, the right ones.
Oh, yeah. I'm just happy it's coming to DVD so it can finally take its proper place in a high school history class when the teacher's sick. Booyah! Anyway, no, a very, you know, it's a movie that happened and it's not bad-ish, so check it out. Nick, that was on your, like, top five this year, wasn't it?
It was two. I think that film is a masterwork. Yes.
Agree to disagree. Killing Them Softly, also coming out. That is the film that I was kind of ambivalent on. Does anyone else remember with more certainty what their reaction to that film was?
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, I like it too. It's good fun.
Yeah, it's great fun. I think it has some very great moments. I think there's some that are uneven, but definitely, definitely worth a look. I quite enjoyed that. Other things coming out that maybe we could talk about a little bit. Every Jurassic Park film, the Terminator anthology. Yeah. Robert Bresson's A Man Escaped.
Oh, that's a great movie.
Yeah. And The Sandlot.
That is not a great movie.
What?
I've never even seen it.
Jesus Christ. Anyway, I'm sure it's not that great, but, you know, my nostalgia filter won't allow me to say that.
Oh, The Borgias.
Is The Borgias good? I haven't seen it.
I saw a preview before Stoker, and it looked kind of funny.
Okay.
Which I don't think is the goal.
Probably
also,
not.
Also, while we're on TV, Veep.
Yep, Veep is fantastic.
Season. Yeah, Veep is very good. It's I'm looking forward to the new season coming back, I think, next month. And, yeah, the first season of Veep is really strong.
Yeah, I don't think there's a bum episode in that entire lot.
Yeah, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus really doing a good job of breaking away from the whole Seinfeld thing.
Yeah, her character in that is fantastic.
Yeah, but the best, of course, is Jonah. Far and away.
Oh, my God.
He's just something else.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, so Veep coming out to Blu-ray. You should check that out. Coming to theaters. Stellar week. A lot to look forward to. G.I. Joe Retaliation, The Host, which is the newest film based on a novel by that woman who did the Twilight stuff. However, written and directed by Andrew Niccol, who did Gattaca, so there's...
He also did In Time.
Yeah, you know, let's not focus on...
It looks more like on the In Time scale.
Yeah. In all, like, shiny things and people in suits running through a very cheap-looking world.
Yeah, it looks cheap.
Looks like it. I mean, it's shot in the middle of the fucking desert. They have, like... A couple of nickel-plated helicopters, and anyway, Tyler Perry's Temptation, The Place Beyond the Pines, which is the new film by the director of Blue Valentine, and Room 237, the documentary about The Shining.
Yeah, so there's two good movies opening next weekend. Yeah. I thought it was all
limited release,
crap.
Though. Limited release, but I mean,
yeah. Place Beyond the Pines actually, I think, opened... I thought it opened this week.
Maybe
no?
It's expanding? I don't know.
I don't know. No, it would appear not. That's weird. Okay.
That is weird.
Never mind. Also, Welcome to the Punch with Mark Strong and James McAvoy looks you know, looks kind of like a fun British thriller, my kind of thing.
I do like the name.
Yeah. And oh boy, Wrong.
Wrong is hitting. That's fantastic.
That was awkward.
Yeah.
Jesus. Yeah. So if you want to know what we think of Wrong, you should listen to our podcast on Wrong.
I think a lot of things about that movie, and one thing at the same time.
Oh, Jesus.
Let me just say, Room 237, I think we've all heard very good things about it.
I have, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And Place Beyond the Pines is quite good. I liked it very much, and even though I do think that it is... It has certain problems that I feel like could have been easily corrected. It is actually in part interesting because of those issues, and it is it's admirable, which I feel funny saying. It is an admirable film because of the way it sort of embraces scope. It isn't limiting itself. It has a wide reach, and I feel like it does not falter that much in doing some big things. So, right. Yeah.
So high praise from Nick Newman.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like an 8 out of 10.
Excellent.
Really, you know, solid.
A solid 8 out of 10.
Yeah, and then G.I. Joe Retaliation, I've heard, is kind of fun, but I'll never see that movie.
I'm sure that I'll be drunk at some point, and someone will put that on. I have only sure the enough. Foggiest memory of watching the original G.I. Joe because it was on Netflix Instant, and I was halfway into a bottle of whiskey. And I put it on as a joke, and everyone thought I was going to take it off, but I did not. And we watched the whole damn thing.
Wow.
I remember so little of it.
You know, the first time Jordan and I met in person, we saw G.I. Joe together, if you can believe that. So.
This is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
I know, and now actually, we saw it the day after it came out, so I guess the day after Retaliation comes out, we'll sever our friendship. So it's very sad, actually.
I was about to say, that sounds awful.
Now, I don't know what's going to happen when the third one comes out. God knows.
A dramatic dramatic reconciliation.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, let's talk about the things that we've watched on our own. So, Danny, why don't you start us off?
Well, I watched a few things that we've mentioned recently, which is kind of funny. I watched Shallow Grave last night, which was pretty great.
Yeah.
Agree with you there.
Excellent. Glad to
hear. Then I watched Miami Vice, which the director's cut, and that was awesome. That was awesome.
You've just been taking notes, haven't you? You're like, I gotta watch all these.
Yeah. And then I watched another man film, Ali. And I can't remember if anyone's mentioned that on the show before.
I just rewatched that a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, you like it?
Oh yeah. Ali is fantastic.
And it was kind of cool because I remember watching the movie and like the opening 10 minutes.
Oh God!
It's like this amazing montage of like a whole life, basically, and a whole era in like 10 minutes, and then the first fight in the film is almost in real time. It's probably like a 15-minute sequence. So the first 30 minutes of the film is probably some of like the best work I've seen from Michael Mann, and I say that as a pretty big fan of his. And there's an essay actually on Mubi, by Ignaty Vishnevetsky.
Mubi?
Mubi.
I've never heard it referred to that way.
I wish I heard it referred to that way more often.
There's an essay.
I'm sorry, but that sounds like my mom referring to movie. So anyway.
I just forget it. It's not that interesting. Okay. I actually have a friend who pronounces it that way, so it's kind of like been... It's been like... movie. There's a whole essay Ignaty Vishnevetsky wrote on basically just the first 10 minutes of the film. Mm-hmm. And it's not that long of a piece, but it's just kind of... just speaks to like how much is going on there. And, you know, the film overall is kind of significant within Mann's filmography because I think it's the first time he started working with video.
It is, yeah.
And, I mean, I love the way he handles that aesthetic, and it's really works here in, like, early scenes where, like, Will Smith is jogging and just the way it kind of expresses the light. And so I'm a big fan of Ali, and it's one of those movies that you hear about it and you think you know what you're going to watch, but it's just kind of like not like that. I'm not sure I've seen another biopic quite like it.
Right, because it's not really about Muhammad Ali, quote unquote. It's not about that figure. It is really it's about public and private ascendancy.
Yeah.
That's what man is most concerned with. Obviously, he has a lot of respect and reverence for Muhammad Ali, but the idea of a A to B biopic is something he clearly just could not be bothered with. And when the movie came out, a lot of people railed against it for that. They felt that he didn't focus enough on, oh, where's the feud with Joe Frazier? Where's the Parkinson's? Where's all the fun verbal rhyming whatnot? Even though that's in there, it's more an aside. But you watch it and then you realize that it's actually about a man who is becoming more than a man. And it's by a director named Man, which is sort of funny, I guess. So my point just sort of fell apart as I made that joke. That was almost my Muhammad Ali verbal dexterity on display.
A man named Man makes a movie about a man becoming more than a man.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Except it doesn't rhyme, so it's not.
I mean, man rhymes with man.
No, it doesn't
look,
rhyme.
Look, I'm not alien. I can't make genre-defining raps, okay?
Yeah.
Nick, why don't you tell us what you watched?
Okay, I'm going to go with Sabrina, which is a 1954 movie directed by Billy Wilder.
It's the one about the teenage witch, right?
Yes, it is. yes. Has anybody here seen it? Anybody partaken in the...
I do not believe that I have
Sabrina.
That. No. Yeah, no, I haven't.
Anybody seen the remake with Harrison Ford?
I thought that was Selena.
No, I think it's Sabrina. Anyway. Okay. I'm not talking about that movie, so who cares? It stars Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant. What am I thinking? Audrey Hepburn and Humphrey Bogart, two very different actors. Please pardon me. I watched another movie today with Cary Grant, so he was sort of on my mind. Anyhow.
Isn't he on your mind?
Exactly, yeah. An interesting item, because the first half, first 45 minutes or so is pretty spectacular, and then the second is not quite as good when it tries to settle into more of a traditional romance, which is something that I think Wilder in his later works was more interested in subverting. You look at something like It Hot or The Apartment. In relation to the latter film, this is actually the second movie he made. It's the first of those two in which a romance is started because of a failed suicide attempt, which I don't really know what it is about that appeals to him, but it is the first tale in which that happens. And I think that the movie kind of strays into more conventional territory that I wasn't quite as fond of, but I did still enjoy it because Audrey Hepburn and Humphrey Bogart, I almost said Cary Grant again, Jesus Christ.
together.
Obviously, they're a very enjoyable on-screen couple. I mean, you don't need me to tell you that, even if you haven't seen them together. And that works quite well. And, of course, Wilder is one of the greatest directors who has ever lived. So there's something to be found there, too. Even if I don't completely love it, I do think that it is worth checking out, in part because of what does not work. Sort of like Spring Breakers, actually. Yeah. Okay. It's on Netflix Watch Instantly, too, so I would recommend checking it out because it is rather enjoyable.
Excellent. I, too, have a Netflix Watch Instant selection for you all people at home. It's part of the TV documentary series called The American Experience, and this particular episode that you should check out is Into the Deep, America, Whaling, and the World. It is a documentary. I think it's – I can't remember how long it is. A little over an hour and a half, I think. And it is about the whaling industry in America from its humble beginnings to its peak and eventual decline. And it is one of the most fascinating things that I've ever watched. Like, I guess people don't talk about whaling a lot in, like, romantic terms because of the way that we know it today, which is, like, this industrialized slaughter of animals for seemingly no reason.
Dude, but, I love that shit.
You would. But the way that it was, and like the fact that the whaling industry is like the thing that gave rise to industry in America, basically driving an industrial revolution, and just the way that it came about and the extremes that these people would go to go hunt whales from a, you know, people in a rowboat, like going out into the open ocean, and having to harpoon this animal, and then this the incredible effort to process the blubber into oil on the ship, and just the years-long journeys that they would have to go on for these things. It's incredible. And it's narrated by Willem Dafoe. And, you know, I could listen to that guy talk forever. He's got a very distinctive voice.
He sounds like a good fit for that.
Is that who I'd think of to narrate something? His voice is so sinister.
It's weird because he actually, in this documentary, he has this very odd voice. He sounds very reverent about what he's speaking about. And this is a random personal piece of information. And the reason I watch this is kind of because I'm really into this art form called scrimshaw. Does anyone know what this is?
Absolutely not.
No.
It started off. It along with like jazz and comic books are called like the quintessential American arts, like the things that we created that we didn't just adapt from someone else. And scrimshaw came about because sailors would take these ivory teeth from these whales. And they would polish them, and then they'd etch into them, and they'd rub ink into the etchings, and it would create these scenes. So it's like an etching of a scene into this whalebone or this whale's tooth. Huh. And, it's really quite beautiful, and I have a couple of knives. I believe they obviously you can't use ivory or whale's teeth anymore. I think mine are elk antler or reindeer antler. But it's really fantastic, and it's just, you know, things like that that, you know, you might not know about, that you'll watch this movie and you'll start to understand the impact that this had and how huge it was for the country before it eventually tapered off. And yeah, it's fantastic. And weirdly enough, I've been to the last whaling port in America, in New Bedford.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it's such a it's weird because at some point they say it's like it was the biggest, like most wealthy city, and now it's just kind of an okay town. And yeah, I mean, once an industry like that leaves and that's all you've been adapted for, there's not a lot to go on there. But yeah, a couple of other famous people lend their voices to this as well. There's Vincent Kartheiser.
Yeah.
Who's Pete Campbell, the eminently punchable cast member of Mad Men, as well as Robert Sean Leonard and Kaylee Thorne, who was pretty good on Rescue Me. So yeah.
And I should also mention, Vincent Kartheiser is a dead ringer for a friend of the show, Ethan Vespe.
Really?
Yeah. If you look at a picture of Ethan and then Vincent Kartheiser, they look exactly alike.
That I can never meet Ethan Vespe in person then, because I'm going to be like, fuck you, Campbell, and then just lay one on him.
Yeah.
Fist. Anyway. So yeah, that's mine. Kind of off the beaten path, but again, I don't know if it's just me because I'm like a romantic about the bygone eras and they quote a lot of Melville. But yeah, I think it's absolutely fantastic. So check it out.
Yeah, it sort of sounds like Leviathan.
Yes.
I've heard great things about Leviathan and yeah. I wanna see it.
Oh yeah, so do I.
Yeah. It's weird because they're the people who, like, Melville was a whaler, and yet the way that he writes about them, it's so reverent, and like he portrays them as like these angels in the ocean, and yet like these are the people who went out and slaughtered them, but they, you know, they felt reverence towards them. It's weird. Apparently Quakers were the best whalers. They're the people who like settled Nantucket, and something about their sense of community and their religious rigidity really lended itself to being a whaling community. I don't know. It's weird. You know, it's interesting.
You know who was a Quaker? Richard Nixon.
Really?
Yeah, that was actually the first time I'd ever heard of the Quaker subset was when I was doing a project on Richard Nixon when I was in the fifth grade. So anyway, that has nothing to do with what you're discussing.
That's a good way.
I can't believe I even just said that.
it's a good way to wrap up. Richard Nixon was a Quaker. Hopefully, ladies and gentlemen, this has been a very educational podcast for you all. Let us know what you think. Drop us a line, a comment, and a rating. podcast@thefilmstage.com. Check us out on iTunes. And you can also follow us elsewhere online and on Twitter. So let's tell them where we can do that, gentlemen. Danny, why don't we start with you?
Ah, yes, certainly. TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin, And Mubai.
And Nick, what about yourself?
Twitter.com/Nick_Newman and thefilmstage.com. I wish I could think of some sort of very bizarre mispronunciation of one of those sites right off the cuff, but I can't. Twitter?
I was about to say Twitter.
The film stage.
The film stage.
Stage.
The film stage. Anyway.
Yeah, so.
And I, of course, can be found at thefilmstage.com as well as my personal site, dearfilm.net. And you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/BrianJRoan, BrianJRoan. Haven't spelled it out in a while. I'm worried that I'm missing people because of that. Some jackass who spells his name with a Y is getting all my followers. Anyway, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. And everyone listening at home, make sure to join us next week. Don't let my prickly exterior just, you know, completely ruffle your feathers and don't, fucking shit, what am I even talking about? Vanessa Hudgens, Patty, can't. I'm not a dictator, you know? I'd like to get some, oh, fuck, words escape me. Anyway, so that
killing
brings us...
Killing it.
Killing it.